Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga. Political analysts and rights groups welcome reports that Sudan may hand former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court.
We are waiting to see if the survivors and victims of atrocities in Darfur will get the opportunity to see justice done.
The Zimbabwe government grapples with corruption in the civil service after allegations that funds set for COVID-19 mitigation were misused.
This tragedy or this corruption happens on top of another corruption. Zimbabwe is just a corrupt country. There's too much corruption. I mean, corruption in Zimbabwe is well documented.
And the Electoral Commission of Zambia is calling on candidates of the just concluded polls to have patience as the electoral body compiles results from all of the country's 10 provinces.
And for us as a commission, this gives us a sense of pride because we look at the total number of registered voters that is slightly above 7 million.
Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Political analysts and race groups have welcomed reports that Sudan may hand former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. Bashir is wanted by the court for alleged crimes in the Darfur region. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Various Sudanese officials suggested this week that Sudan is ready to turn former President Omar al-Bashir over to the court. However, the final decision rests with Sudan's ruling sovereign council, which consists of military and civilian leaders. Hassan Khenenji, head of the Horn Institute for Strategic Studies, says sending Bashir to the ICC will help move the country forward.
It's going to play a role enhancing some confidence, especially when it comes to the victims and the rebels. Part of the agreements with rebel groups was to hold those people who committed crimes to account. And I think it's going to go a long way in building confidence and perhaps in reducing future tensions and potential conflict in the years to come.
The ICC indicted Bashir in 2009 on charges of genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity on people living in the Darfur region. Bashir denies the charges. The crimes were allegedly committed as Khartoum attempted to crush an insurgency in Darfur that began in 2003. Bashir ruled Sudan for 30 years until the army ousted him in 2019 after months of mass protest. He was convicted of corruption and still faces other charges related to his seizure of power through a military coup in 1989. The former ruler is currently in a Khartoum court. ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan, who visited the Sudanese capital this week, said Thursday the government needs to cooperate with the court.
Regarding an individual, former President Omar al-Bashir, I have not discussed dates. I had discussions with the various parts of the government which they are aware of. They know their responsibilities and they will, you know, announcements will be made when decisions are taken that become public. In terms of the Rome Statute I mentioned, I was informed that a meeting of the Joint Council is scheduled for next week. We will see what that brings. Ultimately, the decision to cooperate and how to cooperate is one to be decided by Sudan, not by me.
Sarah Jackson is the Deputy Regional Director of Amnesty International East Africa. She says surrendering Bashir to the court will go a long way toward providing justice to the victims in Darfur.
We are waiting to see if the survivors and victims of atrocities in Darfur will get the opportunity to see justice done.
This would be a very important moment for victims, for survivors, for their families in Darfur.
The transitional government in Khartoum reached a peace deal with the rebels in the Darfur region last October, but the region continues to witness violence. In December, the U.S. government took Sudan off the list of state-sponsored terrorist nations and pledged to economically support the transitional government. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
grappling with corruption in the civil service after allegations that funds set for COVID-19 mitigation were misused. Adegonda gives us more on the story.
Auditor General Mildred Chiri's special audit report presented to Parliament reveals systematic abuses such as the use of fake names, identity documents and mobile phone numbers in the suspected misuse of US $89 million or close to Zimbabwean $800 million in COVID aid money. According to the report, the audit staff could not confirm whether millions of dollars were spent legally and appropriately. The money was intended for small to medium businesses that lost income during COVID-19 lockdowns, as well as for people with disabilities, the elderly, food insecure households, chronically ill persons, and households led by children. It also was intended to pay for protective gear and supplies for medical workers, as well as additional pay allowances for frontline workers. Socio-political analyst Kanyile Mlochwa notes that Zimbabwe has long had a problem with corruption, but that during a crisis, it is particularly jarring.
I believe the abuse of funds linked to a tragedy or a crisis such as COVID-19 is worse. In Zimbabwe, what is worse is that this tragedy or this corruption happens on top of another corruption. Zimbabwe is just a corrupt country. There's too much corruption. I mean, corruption in Zimbabwe is well documented. It's unacceptable.
The Auditor General's report lists a variety of glaring problems. For instance, the government planned to drill 48 water wells in 6 provinces, but the Auditor General found 31 of the wells had no pumping equipment, even though more than $6 million had been spent on them. The lack of wells put communities at risk of hunger or increased COVID cases. Over half of urban households and 2/3 of rural respondents surveyed between March and July 2020 reported going hungry and skipping meals due to lack of resources to obtain food. The report also says some funds went to people with fictitious or suspicious names and identity numbers. Some had false and insufficient contact details. In addition, there was no follow-up mechanism to verify whether the beneficiaries existed or the allowances had reached the intended people. The funds have been budgeted starting last year using government revenue and funds from local businesses and international partners. Zimbabwe had received US $119 million in aid from developmental partners in the fight against COVID-19. The US Embassy contributed US $20 million in support of COVID-19 response in Zimbabwe. Finance and Economic Planning Minister Mtuli Ncube has said the government spent about US $300 million of its revenue, or roughly about 18% of the country's 2020 revenue, on COVID-19 mitigation. He said the Global Fund gave US $49 million toward the effort. Government critics allege Health Minister Constantino Chiwenga, who is also vice president, sat on the audit report for months. The Auditor General recently sent a copy of the report to National Assembly Speaker Jacob Mdenda, and some of the allegations in it have been made public. Farai Magu of the Center for Natural Resource Governance says the Zimbabwe economy could be doing much better were it not for corruption.
Now, how much difference can this money make to the ordinary Zimbabwean? But it's not about sanctions. It is about corruption. If Zimbabwe can account for every penny and use the money for public goods, let's just stop the hemorrhaging of our economy.
The Ministries of Public Service, Labour and Social Welfare, and Health and Childcare did not respond when VOA sought their responses to the issues raised in the legislature. Reporting for VOA, this is Adegono in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The Electoral Commission of Zambia is calling on candidates of the just-concluded polls to have patience as the electoral body compiles results from all of the country's 10 provinces. There was a massive voter turnout at polling stations across the country, including Lusaka. This despite concerns that the deployment of heavy security, including the police, military and paramilitary groups, would deter opposition supporters from voting. VOA's Peter Klote in the Zambian capital, Lusaka, has this report.
Zambia election officials say they will announce the outcome of Thursday's elections within 72 hours after the last citizen voted late in the night. Electoral Commission spokesperson Patricia Luhanga says the commission is pleased with the large turnout.
The numbers we've seen are quite unprecedented. And for us as a commission, this gives us a sense of pride because we look at the total number of registered voters that is slightly above 7 million. And we look at the queues that we've experienced on poll day, and we have nothing but a sense of pride.
Some voters began standing in line at the polling stations around 1 a.m. Thursday, 5 hours before voting began. Cholwe Hapondela was among those who were in line hours early at the Kapulonga Boys Secondary School polling station in Lusaka. Election officials said some people had slept at the school to ensure their place in line.
Actually, I didn't sleep. I've been waiting for this day for the past 5 years, and I'm glad it's here today. Well, I just want to exercise my rights as a youth. I'm very excited about this one.
Lucky Kawaya was not put off by the long queue at Vera Chiluba Primary School Polling Center in Lusaka.
If you register to vote, there's no reason why you shouldn't vote. Just join the queue, vote, and make your leaders. Choose your leaders. Nobody else will choose your leaders for you.
Analysts had expressed concern about potential violence during the elections, clashes between supporters of the governing Patriotic Front, or PF, and partisans of the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND Alliance, left two people dead in one constituency in Lusaka earlier this month. The violence, officials say, led to the deployment of the military to that constituency to help maintain law and order. The Electoral Commission also imposed campaign bans in the constituency. It, however, lifted the restriction after the military was sent to other parts of the city to keep the peace. Thursday's general election was mostly peaceful, despite reports of violence in parts of the country. The Electoral Commission's Luhanga says at least one person died during voting.
It's quite interesting, really, that despite most of the country being peaceful, we have received reports of violence, specifically in the southern province of Zambia, as well as northwestern province. And unfortunately for northwestern province, we have recorded a death. This, we are working closely with Zambia police to establish what happened. And because it's a criminal nature, we'll have to have Zambia police deal with it holistically.
Officials of the African Union Poll Observer Mission said the process was peaceful. Representatives of political parties at the polling stations they visited, they say, had no problems and were pleased with how the elections were administered. Former Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma, who led the AU observers, told VOA he was pleased with how Zambians behaved during voting. Koroma commended the patience and decorum of the large crowds at the polling stations he visited. He also praised the professionalism of the Electoral Commission staff at the polling stations, as well as the police there to maintain the peace. Before Election Day, Koroma met with many stakeholders, including incumbent President Edgar Lungu, his main rival Hakainde Hichilema, other presidential candidates, civil society and religious groups. He called on the candidate to accept the outcome of Thursday's vote.
We have cautioned them, even those that have concerns, we will address the concerns. It's all part of building the democratic process. We will continue to engage, but the concerns should not cause anybody to reject the outcome. There are constitutional methods to adopt if you are in disagreement with the outcome.
The Electoral Commission says results from urban areas have begun trickling in. Officials say they will give regular updates to keep the country informed about the vote counting process. Election analysts say they expect the results of the presidential election to be declared this weekend. However, if none of the 16 presidential candidates capture more than 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff. For VOA, I'm Peter Clote reporting from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
Churches in Zimbabwe are questioning the government's sincerity in allowing them to hold services for the vaccinated when only about 10% of the population has gotten jabs against COVID-19. The government said this week that Christians who had received two shots could gather, a move some see as a way to drive up inoculation, given that more than 70% of the country's population is Christian. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare for VOA News.
This week, Zimbabwe Information Minister Monica Mchangwa told reporters that the government had noticed a decline of new COVID-19 cases. Therefore,
Cabinet wishes to inform the public that churches can now allow sit-in congregants under the following conditions. Only congregants who have received 2 doses of the vaccine are allowed to attend. And all Ministry of Health and Childcare and WHO protocols have to be adhered to. And those found in breach will be arrested, including the leaders of church.
The government said it would not extend that permission to bars as most drinkers were vaccinated and did not believe in the mark of the beast theory, which some church leaders were preaching to discourage congregants from getting vaccines. On Friday, Blessing Makwara, General Secretary of the Evangelical Fellowship of Zimbabwe, said churches were still digesting the government statement and will soon issue a statement to members taking note of.
Number one, our acknowledgement of government's desire to contain the COVID-19 pandemic. Two, our members' varying positions on COVID-19 vaccinations. And three, the unavailability of enough vaccines to cover at least 60% of the population.
More than 1.9 million Zimbabweans out of a population of 14 million have received their first vaccination shots, and nearly 1.2 million have received their second inoculation. This is partly due to hesitancy among citizens and the intermittent shortages of vaccines. Harare-based political commentator Rejoice Ngwenya says the development should not be mistaken for the fear of God by the government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa and the ruling ZANU-PF party.
No, they have opened one eye towards the election 2023, hoping that perhaps even the so-called apostolic movement can be able to support them. It's some sort of appeasement. Look, the schools are not yet open. Pubs are not open, sports has not resumed, you know, weddings and funerals are still under, you know, bondage. So I believe that there's something that has to do with the cunning eye of ZANU-PF to be able to start canvassing for votes and using churches as a springboard for populist benevolence.
Zimbabwe currently has 118,754 confirmed coronavirus infections and 4,047 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the global outbreak. The government says the vaccination program is intensifying, targeting what it calls hotspots. The number of cases has been rising lately as the Delta variant becomes more widespread. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Malawi had nearly 7 million malaria cases last year, more than a third of the population, with 2,500 lives lost to the mosquito-borne disease. However, one village has become a model for how to eradicate malaria, and in June was honored as the first ever to have zero malaria cases for a whole year. Lameka Masina reports from Machinga District in southern Malawi.
Margaret Kachere, a resident of Mwigara village, recounts a day in 2009 when her family of 5 children was about to lose their second-born child to malaria. She says that day her body was too hot and she would often faint. I took her to a traditional healer, but it did not help. It was so terrible that one could not sleep. This forced me to take her to the hospital the following day, where she got help after diagnosed with malaria. Kachere's family members are among thousands in Mwigara village who have long been affected by malaria, largely because of beliefs and misconceptions against the use of mosquito nets as a preventive measure. She says, we believed that if one sleep under a mosquito net, they would suffer from loss of libido. And also, if that one sleeps under the net, would die soon because the net symbolizes a coffin. So we were afraid to sleep under the mosquito net. But the community-driven anti-malaria campaign, which started in 2016, has changed that perception. Now, Mwikala, home to over 12,000 people, has become a model village for combating malaria. In June of this year, Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera honored the village's chief for reducing malaria infection and for recording zero cases since 2017. Chakwera spoke during the televised launch of the nationwide anti-malaria campaign in Machinga District. He said what this village has done has given me hope that if everyone follows what they do, the campaign to make Malawi free from malaria is possible. Malaria is the number one killer disease in Malawi and accounts for 36% of hospital outpatients and 15% of hospital admissions. Last year alone, malaria killed 2,500 people in Malawi, more than any other disease, including COVID-19. The village's award is owed to a group of community volunteers who taught the villagers about malaria prevention measures. Their activities include drama, community health talks, and door-to-door campaigns. This has forced people from surrounding villages to learn about the measures. And also, the village chief augmented the campaign by formulating laws that require villagers to use mosquito nets. Yasin Mustafa is a senior chief for Mwikala village. He says, I have introduced the bylaws to prevent people from abusing mosquito nets. Some people would sell the free mosquito nets to fishermen, so anyone disobeying the bylaws would pay a fine of $6. He says, I use the money to buy the mosquito net and I give it to those who don't have. Now, Mwikala community volunteers say that funds permitting, they will take their anti-malaria campaign to nearby villages or beyond. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Machinga District, Malawi.
Concerted efforts are underway by local health authorities and World Health Organization experts to prevent the spread of the deadly Marburg disease within Guinea and across borders. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Health workers are in a good position to contain Marburg disease before it gets out of control and infects and kills many people. The World Health Organization says no further cases of Marburg have been identified since the index case was confirmed August 9th in Guinea's southern Gekedu prefecture. The WHO reports the infected patient has died and 150 people who came in contact with him have been identified. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib tells VOA that 10 WHO experts are on the ground supporting the government's efforts to step up the emergency response. She says teams are tracing all those who encountered the patient. She says the incubation period for Marburg is 2 to 21 days, the same as that for Ebola.
Although Marburg and Ebola are from both members of the same family, they are caused by different viruses. The two diseases are clinically similar. It's only by lab testing that we can differentiate them. But they have the same clinical feature, the same symptoms.
Both Marburg and Ebola are highly infectious diseases that cause hemorrhagic fever. They have a fatality rate that can vary from 24% to 90%. Ebola now has a vaccine, but Marburg has no cure and no vaccine. The first case of the disease was identified in 1967 in a man from Marburg, Germany. He had contracted the disease while working in Uganda. Previous outbreaks and sporadic cases cases have been reported in Angola, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Kenya, South Africa, and Uganda. The current outbreak in Guinea is the first in West Africa. The virus was detected less than 2 months after Guinea declared an end to an Ebola outbreak that erupted earlier this year. Shaib says it is important to quickly stop the virus in its tracks, so she says cross-border surveillance is being enhanced with neighboring Sierra Leone and Liberia to quickly detect any cases of Marburg.
For now, 200 people were screened for the disease in the three countries, in the three borders, and no one showed symptoms for the disease.
According to the WHO, Marburg often starts abruptly with a high fever and severe headache, then progresses to severe bleeding from multiple areas. The disease is transmitted to people from fruit bats and spreads among humans through direct contact with the bodily fluids of infected people, surfaces, and materials. Shaib says investigations are ongoing to determine the source of the virus in Guinea. She says the man who got sick and died is known to have been in a forested area where he most likely became infected. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi surprised Egyptians when he announced it's time to increase the price of a loaf of bread. Changes to food subsidies are highly sensitive in a country where a decision to cut bread subsidies led deadly riots in 1977. Observers said the new move would test the silence and patience of Egyptians who have kept quiet about other price hikes, and that the issue of bread could be a ticking time bomb. Amin Said, an Egyptian public opinion analyst, discussed the possibility of bread protests with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi.
The trouble with such analysis is that they take the historical precedent of 1977 when the IMF agreement led to the surprise hike in the prices of bread and many foodstuffs, and so people exploded. At that time, we had political parties that were active in the street, especially the left, and they controlled the trade unions, and they were active. And so there was a big riots that led in the end to the government ending all those measures and back to normalcy. So price of oil and electricity and a lot of other things had been jumping and nothing happened. You had the Nile issue. There were many calls by opposition abroad for people to take an action. There was a call for a revolt on the Nile in June and also in July, and maybe another call also on Twitter in September. And so far, nothing happened. And that's why the government felt that the agreement with IMF is very important. People also fear the alternative. They cannot jump into the unknown. They see the Middle East is full of disturbances and very unstable these days. And jumping into the unknown puts a lot of fear into the minds of Egyptians. And so nobody is moving, despite the fact that they may be objecting and do not like it. But at the same time, they feel that the price can be high and they don't want to pay it now. And that's why there was this kind of acceptance and only noise in the social media that comes from abroad.
Sisi's government has turned to the IMF, which granted a $12 billion loan in 2016 and a one-year $5.2 billion loan last year. But the IMF specified that food subsidies should only reach those most in need and also required higher fuel and electricity prices as an economic reform. Could protest laws in Egypt limit the prospects of the once common street demonstrations, thus allowing President Sisi to quietly pass his economic reform plans?
The Egyptians have tried demonstration and evolution twice in the last decade, 2011, 2013, and things got worse than before. And so I don't think that it is a problem of law and security. I mean, there was law and security in 2011, and Egyptians revolted against Mubarak for 18 days and toppled them. So it's not a question of fear. If the people really felt that there is hope, and that demonstration and evolution would lead to a better future, then they would have demonstrated and they would have broken any culture of fear. But because they feel that there is nothing going to come out of that, and they feel that their country is the only country in the Middle East that is achieving economic growth and stability despite corona that is hitting the area and terrorism and trouble in the whole area in general, they just feel that let's wait and see how things will end up in the future.
Egypt's bread subsidy program amounts to about 48 billion Egyptian pounds, and it's available to some 70 million Egyptians. However, the government has been criticized for not being effective enough in reducing poverty in Egypt. The government is trying to secure 8 billion Egyptian pounds to fund school meals, which will be distributed in the coming new school year. Would such a program calm the Egyptian public opinion regarding the hike in bread price?
The government sold this decision to raise the price of bread under the slogan that they will channel the money to school children, which nobody would object. And that's why it would pass, I think.
That was Amin Said, an Egyptian public opinion analyst, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi. And it's now time for our Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
But baby, our matter don't they for street seats. Now come see the pressure they won't give it. I don't know why they don't fit to let us be. But what since we jam, we the only feel love, loving. Teasing each other, but we still not let go. Maybe old time people, where's the gun, I'm a soul. See our from family people. Tell me where to be them, oh no. They get issues so they can't stand our love. If the old time people waste the night, jam a school. Cut it all, twisted them, them once world our love. Tell me waiting be them, oh no. Can't guy love, night job, baby. Night job, big love, you can't guy, yo. See when they come together. Just like he is supposed to be. Night job, guy love, can't baby. Can't guy love, the night job, guy, yo. Nice one to hook together. The love they like supposed to be. Woo! Shop some money from the oil and gold. Party with the party so. Oh, so so wine and she come they go. She the wine like she they on top of moto. Post this on a boy set ya yeah, get some more. Feel like going down to the floor. Like night job in love. Night job in love. She can look at picture. See when they come together. Just like any supposed to be. Night job in love. Can love in love. Just like you. Next one to make.
feeling you long. You give me a melody and your busy tongue. Quench my fire within the leader was a tank. So baby, you mean more to me than CDs and Nairas. And if you wear the money, baby, I'll take up the bribe.
Tatizo tulivuka pamoja, hakunitupa mkono. Ukanifunza mapenzi chia moto, michepuko ina kikomo. Ukagawana rejibu kati yani, tamaa kuiba nafasi yani. Ukanitia moyo nitapata nani, kwa nini sikia wajina nani. Ukagawana rejibu kati yani, tamaa kuiba nafasi yani. Ukanitia moyo nitapata nani.
Kama mboga na kumbeleza, kunichomeza.
Baby, forever. We gon' make it through. Together, in our way. We gon' make it through. Together, in our way. ukirudi nikupokei isha nilevu nikotoka mana najua umechoka sugar you're my baby forever we gon' make it together in our way tunapendana sugar you're my baby forever we gon' make it together in our way tunapendana wewe siwezi bila wewe eti niishi mimi mwenyewe maisha yangu bila wewe.
Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline Africa team. We thank you for joining us tonight. And join us tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
Straight Talk Africa. We will celebrate the records, the medals, and the victories of Africa's greatest athletes at the Tokyo Olympics. We'll also look at what it would take to bring the Summer Olympics to Africa. We'll examine what kind of investment would be needed and whether Africans really want to host the Games. Join me, Heidi Adams, on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.